Hello, and welcome back to Elistink's Tales from the Script. I'm your host, Tom Moore. This week, our guest is Matt MacDonald, who is also Elistink's poetry consultant, and he's come to us today with one of his rare pieces of prose. So, without any further ado, we're going to run straight ahead with Matt's story. Take it away, Matt.
I woke up on the floor of a strange bedroom, clutching a single bullet in my right hand. I couldn't see any sign of a gun. Not a real gun, anyway. The gun of my dreams was enough. I could almost taste the sharp metal tang, the sick undertones of mud and sweat, of clothes worn too many days in a row, the smell of blood and iron. I felt a wave of nausea roll my empty stomach, glad that I had nothing left to throw up. I was curled in a ball in the corner of the room. I'd never tell my family, but I just couldn't sleep in the bed. Not really. It didn't feel right. Not after the months and months of sleeping on slats, on wood, the mud and the dead. After that, comfort wasn't just a memory. It was something that never even existed. The bed, plain as it was still too comfortable right now. I couldn't find a place to rest without feeling a stationary nausea that threatened me all the time. In the hospital back in London, they told me it could take months, maybe years before I could use some things like normal people do. Normal people. I hated that. The derision, the fear, the tinge of hate. I wasn't human anymore. I'd gone overseas and watched every strip of humanity be ritually pulled like loose flesh from the hearts of men and boys, boys no older than 18. And now, having kept everyone back home safe, having defended king and country, I came back broken. Broken and dismissed. First to London in the military hospital in Whitechapel, and then after 3 weeks of screaming fits, they dismissed me on a familial recuperation. In other words, let the bugger's family deal with him. It'd been 6 weeks. 6 weeks I'd been back in Britain and I still couldn't sleep in a fucking bed. I'd come back into London on a military train, and for 2.5 hours from Dover to London, not a single one of the 50 other men in the carriage said a single thing to anyone else. We were all still there. I could see you. The heavy hanging eyes, the twitches that hadn't quite been covered, the oppressive smell of fear. So many of them reliving their nightmares again and again. A 2-hour kaleidoscope of the worst 20 seconds of the last 2 years. It wasn't till I was on that train that I realised I'd gone 24 months where all I'd seen was men, mud, fireworks without celebration, mud, men, and the dead. Always the dead. I stand up from the floor, uncurling like barbed wire. I have no idea what time it is now. My sense of time passing is shot to hell, like plenty else about me. That and the fact that my appetite for sleep is pretty diminished these days. Sleep for too long in a trench and you wake up dead. Or worse. It doesn't help that it's the middle of January, and even this far south it's dark from 5 p.m. till 8 a.m. I stretch, feeling my palm pushing down against the cold jacket of the bullet, the sharp scrape along the side. I keep my hand wrapped around it, the only thing I was able to bring back from the war that I could show anyone. One of my ankles has gone to sleep, so I wobble as I cross the floor and find the mantelpiece. A single lamp sits on the edge of the mantelpiece, an unspoken gift from my mother to never let me be alone in the dark again. She took my coming back like this harder than anyone else in the house. The hand-wound clock tells me it's 7 a.m. I should be asleep. I should be asleep. I should be able to sleep like anyone else. Another wave of nausea flaps me like a kite in a strong wind, and I grab at the mantelpiece with both hands, and the bullet drops like a bomb to the floor. Once the corkscrew has left my body, I open my eyes, taking a deep breath, testing my legs for their strength. I wish I could eat something and keep it inside. Even the mealy bread that Mother keeps making me sits untouched on the plate, a half-finished glass of water on the bedside table. As my head leans on the plain, unvarnished wood of the mantelpiece, I watch the bullet rocking slowly on the uneven floorboards. A line of harsh scratches, rough and mountainous against the smooth jacket, stand out in the light from the lamp. I remember when I joined up, our training squadron staying up late one night talking in the barracks about soldiers and all the brave things we were going to do. We remembered our grandfathers coming back from the war, those that did, carrying a bullet. They said that somewhere in the world was a bullet with your name on it, and if you carried it, you'd never be shot by it. We all agreed to do the same, in honour. 20 of us sitting in the darkness of youth. When I came back from the war, I didn't have my bullet with me. I'd given mine away to a man with the greenest eyes 4 months into my time in France. He'd given me his. When he was shot, 4 weeks before I came home, I felt as if I'd pulled the trigger myself. When I go to sleep, I'm always holding his bullet, feeling his name press into my skin, hoping that I can bring him back. When I was on the train coming back across Kent, I wasn't thinking about my horrors. I was thinking about his.
Right. Now, would you like to talk a little bit about that story you just read out?
Yeah, I mean, it was something I actually wrote for the application process for the Napier Creative Writing course, the MA, the second year I applied for it. And I was given the first line. That was what we were given. We were given that first line as sort of verbatim, and we had to use it and write a thousand word story on it. And I think through a combination of having watched Blackadder goes forth fairly soon before writing it, and sitting on my computer desk, trying desperately to summon words from the pen I had in my hand, that the various strands of it came together to sort of give the story as it stands. And it's one of the few things I've actually finished that I'm actually proud of.
Because in Blackadder, that kind of thing with the having your own bullet with your name on it, it's played as a joke, whereas
yeah.
I think it's kind of, it's more serious.
Yeah, I mean, it's, if memory serves, it's Baldrick says it, and he shows Blackadder because he thinks he's gone and been really smart and got round it because he's got the bullet. And I was thinking, well, obviously it's played for jokes in Blackadder. What if that was actually what they did? What if they did think, well, if I've got my bullet, no one else can get it at me? And as I was writing it, actually, I know it sounds like a terribly cliched author thing to say, but I didn't see the twist at the end. I didn't see him being gay or that it wasn't his bullet until I was writing it. And then it just sort of flowed into that particular ending. But yeah, I was just thinking, it's the kind of thing that I would expect soldiers to do, is have the bullet.
It's a very interesting inversion of the original idea. I like that. Okay, right. Formative years. What got you interested in writing?
My mother. I read extensively as a child. I was always reading. But from that, you get into thinking about your own stories and whether or not you can make people feel the way that books have made you feel. But yeah, I got into it because I read, and after a while there's only one place you can go with that, because you get such a pull from inside books, and you have to write your own stories.
So what was the first thing you can remember writing?
I wrote a story for a girl I was dating at the time, because that's not terribly cliche and authorly. And it was one of those sort of semi-autobiographical things, using a character similar to me and a character similar to her, but displanting up into the Scottish Highlands, where I have a lot of sort of family connections. And I wrote a thing about, effectively about them breaking up, but getting back together because love wins out. Needless to say, we didn't last. But that was one of the first things, and that was one of the first items that was a proper story with a sort of an application process behind it, thinking of an actual message I was trying to send out. I scribbled notes everywhere, and I always do, I still do. Notes are one of my favourite things about being a writer. In my notebook just now, there's genuinely, with no explanation to it, the line, as tactile as a duck. And I don't know where it came from, but that was one of the first things I remember trying to tell a narrative through.
Yeah.
And it was cheap and it was cliche, but it was fun.
Yeah. So, obviously, you are predominantly write poetry now.
Yes.
That's one of the major things, and you're a listings poetry consultant. You are one of the major kind of minds behind our few and far between poetry gigs.
Yeah.
What kind of steered you towards poetry rather than prose when you started doing it?
Well, I didn't actually have that much of a sort of writerly sort of community with me when I started writing. So I started out doing stories, and obviously the difficult thing about writing stories, so even short stories, is the momentum to keep going, because sometimes you'll get to a point in a story and you don't know where it's going yet, and it can just weigh you down coming back to the same junction until eventually inspiration will take you. And because I didn't have anyone who I could sort of turn and go, this story isn't working, where do I go with it? It kind of just died. And then obviously I got into higher education, I got into poetry, and I realised that it captivates something else about communicating ideas. And because there's a lot less order to it, there's no sort of narrative form behind poetry. So you can just encapsulate an idea or an emotion, and it can be done very quickly. Like, I write speedily when I write poetry. So it's something that just takes no time at all. Fiction is something that takes a little bit more effort. And I sort of got out of the habit of reading prose, and I got out of the habit of writing it.
Do you think there's anything you can take from having started writing poetry and then coming back to prose?
And is there anything you can kind of carry on from poetry into your prose writing, you suppose?
Yeah, I mean, they do, they're obviously trying to do different things, but ultimately, I suppose it's not that they're doing different things, it's that they're doing the same thing a different way. So I find that writing poetry has given me a much broader understanding of visualizing what's going on when I'm thinking about narrative concepts. I'm thinking about crucial moments in a story. I picture them and I can use some of the more unconventional images that poetry can lend itself to think of interesting ways of describing the narrative and bringing things together. It gives you a sense of the whole. Obviously, because poetry, you have to get to the point quickly and interestingly. The challenge to be consistently concise lends itself well to then thinking narratively, because you go, okay, well, I don't actually need this character to do this because it's not important. It's not moving the story forward. So that my attitude to poetry lends itself very well to that sort of narrative drive by making sure that you're keeping everything important to the story.
Okay. Performing. There's obviously performance is quite a big part of poetry because a lot of poetry is done for performance pieces, and a lot of poetry groups are almost predominantly performance poetry groups. And of course, A List Inc. is one of the excellent prose performance groups which are functioning in Edinburgh at the moment. What do you suppose performance adds to a reading, whether it's poetry or prose?
I think it actually works better for prose, oddly enough. And that's because what you can get in a way that you can't get from reading is intonation. Because whenever you read something, you obviously you read it the way you'd speak it out loud. But obviously that's not necessarily the author's voice or even the narrator's voice. And obviously you can get hearing someone perform it, you're not focusing necessarily on the words, you're listening to what's happening and you're focusing on the actual story itself. And I think that lends itself very well to the prose tradition. Obviously, prose is just the descendant of the storyteller tradition. And that hearing someone and seeing someone move with a story, really, it just adds something that you don't get from the page. Comparing it to the poetry side, yeah, there are some poems that are quite clearly written for the page and that don't really work well being performed, because people will just stand up and read them. But it's almost impossible to just read a story because it's got dramatic tension, it's got character voices, it's got different locations. You know, there has to be something that even the writer is involved in. So seeing it performed just adds a layer that you just aren't going to get in any other way.
If you could only do one of prose or poetry, I know it's a horrible question, but if you had to choose which of your children got taken out behind the chemical sheds, which one would you choose?
Oh, it's like Sophie's Choice.
It
I don't know. I'd have to say poetry.
Yeah.
I mean, I love poetry, and it is currently what I spend inordinately most of my time doing, and that's because it is something I can devote to in small moments when I'm doing other things. I don't have to give it as much attention as I do prose, but the stories you can tell in sort of the prose format are much more important than anything I can cobble together in poetry.
See, that's interesting because I think there's a lot of poets who would obviously say the opposite.
I think it's like, to me, prose is about telling the story, and a good writer tells me a good story. Whereas a poet, I'm not so much looking at what they're telling me as how they're telling it to me. So a good poet should be inventive and interesting and invert my expectations of rhyme and rhythm and meter and language and vocabulary and all these things. Whereas I am definitely of the sort of oral storytelling tradition, where it's about the story and how the story moves you, or how the story reaches you, or what the story has to tell you about the world, even if you don't understand it the first time. I mean, one of my favorite authors is Terry Pratchett, and the ones that I like of his are the ones about stories. That sort of the notion of the story as being somehow this extant thing that just authors try to reach really appeals to me. And I think that they are not actually more important than what poets are doing, but certainly reach a broader audience.
Yeah. All right, and going back to performing. Now, a lot of writers, especially, and I don't know exactly if it's the same with poets as well, but obviously, a lot of writers are used to sitting in a room and typing something out and reading lots of things down. So, when it comes to performance, they get quite intimidated by the idea of it. Is there any kind of piece of advice, nice, simple, put on a tagline, piece of advice you could give to a novice performer?
I mean, there's two which are the same, but just different sides of the same coin. One, nobody knows how nervous you are. No one can tell. And the second one, and it's, I've only picked this up recently from having done and listened to people talking to me after performances, you get such a boon of interest and respect for getting on stage and performing. So many people wouldn't even consider it that the mere act of going on, immediately standing in front of them, opens up your audience to you, which is, or at least was certainly for me, was the scary bit. And considering an audience might see me and go, well, we're not listening for the next 7 minutes. But yeah, people respect that you will get up on stage, so
Kind of carrying on, but going back
yeah.
to writing, there's a question that I like asking people because it's kind of reveals something about things. But what do you suppose is the essential trait of a writer? Is what is like one trait that every writer needs, not necessarily even a successful writer, but just, I mean, a successful writer would obviously be more helpful.
Well, naturally. I'm going to stay away from the obvious of alcoholism.
Yes.
It, certainly, again, I suppose it's difficult to pin it down to just not what I would do. It's observation. All the writers I know are constantly aware, not maybe not even in a subconscious way, but they know what's going on around them and they know what that means in terms of fitting into narratives. The essential trait is there's just a continual willingness to have your eyes open to whatever might come into it, because you never know when that one thing someone told you 6 years ago becomes the crucial point in your story. And that willingness to just keep every piece of information to come to them ready and waiting to just use is what makes all writers writers.
I used to have a question where I asked who is your favorite writer, but that's a really horrible question to ask anyone. So I've changed it to if you could live any other writer's career, who would you pick?
Oh, that's an
So it's not
equally
it's,
horrible.
it's not it's a slightly different one because I mean some writers are very, very good, but they're dead. So you don't want to be
Yeah.
those guys.
I mean, I would say it's a slightly awkward answer because it sounds cliché in my head, but I'd want the career of Jack Kerouac, and that exclusively as a writer, not as a cultural icon, not as a as anything like that, because he got such an amount of time to hone what he did in his diaries, in his lesser known works, the ones he printed before, obviously On the Road came and changed everything. And that ability to by the time he got to his later works, he'd had such a run up at it without the palaver, as it were, of hoop jumping and, well, you did this last time, fit that mold again. Where's your next great book? What are you trying to achieve here? Having that ability to hone a talent and then allowing that to get to a germinating point where it can bring the best of your possible work, I think that would be the ideal career. The ability to have the pressure almost come too early so that my actual growth isn't affected by it as a writer. Again, although obviously the not being an alcoholic would be nice.
This is quite a mature attitude because what you're basically saying is you want the ability to, or at least the opportunity to work incredibly hard before you do well,
Yes,
which,
basically.
yeah, is
Yeah.
something that the modern permissive society
Yeah,
always looking down on instant success. But yeah, no, it's a good way of looking at it. Thank you very much for coming along.
glad to be here.
Okay, and that's all we have time for this month on ListInc. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to learn any more about us, please check us out at listinc.net and be sure to listen to our next one next month. Okay, I've been Tom Moore, and thank you for listening. Goodbye.